Hello and welcome to this week's instalment of Nucleus Investment Insights. This week our attention turns to the review of the state of the Australian property market, which after easing for a number of years has now resumed a vigorous climb in prices across most of the major cities. There's been plenty of influences, both positive and negative, over the last year that have provided ample ammunition for property pundit commentators. On the price negative side, we're now a year out from the revelations and report of the Royal Commission into Banking and Finance, which held a dim view on poor lending practices and triggered a broad review of how banks should assess the ability for borrowers to repay loans, which in turn slowed the amount of credit issued. On the positive side, we've surpassed nearly 9 months since the surprise re-election of a pro-property boom government, which coincided with the bottoming of the Melbourne and Sydney pullback, and perhaps a return to normal of the onward march of Australia's favourite asset class. I'm here to ask the question, is the Australian property boom sustainable? I'm joined by our chief economist, Leith Van Onselen. G'day, Leith.
G'day, Tim. Hello, everyone.
Our head of investments, Damien Klassen. Hello, Damien.
Hi, Tim.
And author, president of the tax reform think tank Prosper Australia, and director of the respected real estate advocacy firm Cashmore & Co, Catherine Cashmore. Welcome to Nucleus Investment Insights.
Hi.
Welcome back.
Good to be here.
And just a quick reminder that before we get started, to subscribe on YouTube and click on the notification bell to be notified of when we go live or when we have a new webinar to watch. And follow us on your preferred podcast platform. And finally, give us a like on our various social media stories you find out there in the ether. So with no further ado, let's jump into it. So the agenda today, we're looking at the Australian housing market experiencing a strong rebound, as mentioned. Quarterly price growth strong but slowing. We'll then be rolling into mortgage finance strengthening, which is driving price growth. Some views from the front line from our very own Catherine Cashmore, so looking forward to that. And then finally wrapping up with how these themes impact every day through the portfolios at Nucleus Wealth. So I'll hand over to Leith to get us started on the Australian housing market experiencing a strong rebound.
Yeah, thanks, Tim. Look, I just want to take everyone through just a very, very quick data snapshot, which kind of paints the picture of what the housing market's doing now. To quote CoreLogic, earlier in the week, Australia's housing market is experiencing a, quote, remarkable rebound. It's the strongest property price recovery on record, as far as their data goes. And, of course, it's been driven by the usual suspects, Sydney and Melbourne. Now, after bottoming out mid last year, dwelling values at the five city level have boomed by 8.2%. So that's 8.2% in just about 7 months.
Wow.
And this has been driven by Sydney, where prices, after falling by about 15%, they've already rebounded by 11%, roughly. And Melbourne's has also rebounded by exactly the same, 11.2%. So again, it's the two major capitals, as always. And the primary drivers behind this is obviously there was a change of government. Sorry, the Morrison government was retained. Everyone expected a change of government. Labor's negative gearing and capital gains tax reforms were obviously jettisoned. 2 days after the federal election, APRA eased its interest rate buffer, which basically meant that banks could lend more at lower rates to more people. So it reduced the amount of serviceability required. And that obviously increased the amount that borrowers could lend and the number of borrowers. And then, of course, they've had the RBA's interest rate cuts. Of course, the just starting to happen now, the Morrison government announced a whole bunch of first home buyer subsidies. And there's initially going to be 5,000 subsidies for home buyers to basically borrow only 5%.
Borrow 95%.
Sorry, borrow 95%. Yeah, 5% deposit. And that program's already becoming way oversubscribed, and it's going to basically tap out in February. So they already would have filled the first half's quota, and that's going to be redone in from July 1. It's going to be another 5,000. But I think the Morrison government's going to basically just expand that because it's incredibly popular. Mm. You get a lot of obviously home buyers complaining they missed out, and it's an easy way to juice the market. So yeah, it's basically back to the races anyway. If you look at price growth, and if we switch over to the next chart, I've only got three here. I'm not going to bore everyone with too much charts. I've got a chart here showing quarterly price growth. So Quarterly price growth has come off a bit from last year, but it is still incredibly strong. It's grown at about 5% per quarter in Sydney and Melbourne, which is unbelievable. It got up to about 6.5% late last year. And at the five-city level, so the five major capitals, it's grown about 4%. So that's about 12% annualised. So again, very, very strong. And as was released earlier this week, if you flick to the next chart, Tim, this has all been fueled by a big boom in new mortgages. So new mortgage finance has been has rocketed. And anyone who's watching this and has a chart in front of me, you can see there's an incredibly strong correlation between housing finance and prices, as we'd expect. And the interesting thing is, at the same time as this new mortgage boom has happened, actual overall mortgage credit growth has been falling because we've got people who, with existing mortgages, actually paying them down very quickly. So although overall credit growth's low, it's the quantity of new mortgages that matter for house prices, and that's also booming. So it's a pretty strong market at the moment, obviously. Has probably more juice left in the tank. I reckon it's going to keep rising till late this year, although my personal view is prices will probably slow. Mm-hmm. But there are, of course, a lot of risks on the horizon with the coronavirus, how bad the fallout's going to be from that. Will it knock out Chinese buyers? We will soon be pushing up against affordability constraints again, because probably by the end of March, the housing market will have reached previous highs in nominal terms. Mm-hmm. And by the end of the year, in real terms, which means once you account for inflation. And so affordability is stretched. We're also heading into a weakening economy. The construction sector, which accounts for nearly 10% of jobs, is facing a big downturn as the NBN completes mid-year. And also as we're looking at a huge dwelling construction decline. So we're looking at rising unemployment, and there's going to be more pressure on wages, etc. So my short view is that, yeah, the rest of this year is going to be pretty strong, but I can see it, you know, slowing down. Mm-hmm. Going down to a crawl speed, and with the potential for maybe outright falls next year, especially the coronavirus spreads. So That's my personal view, but I'd love to hear from Catherine. This is because I'm obviously a data wonk, right? So I look at the data. I sit on my computer. I look at the data and everything, but I'm not out there in the front line. So apart from reading, you know, the odd domain spruik, I don't actually have a whole lot of insight into actually what's happening on the ground. So this is why having someone like Catherine come in is so valuable, because she's on the front line. She's a buyer's advocate. She goes to auctions. She obviously negotiates on sales. Does really well by her clients. So I'd love to hear what Catherine's views are, because you know, data can only take you so far, especially when a lot of it's backward looking.
Okay, fantastic. Oh, we'll hand over to Catherine for your take. And I guess, well, just to get us started though, the initial thought for mine was, how much do you think of this rebound is pent up demand from that sort of pre-election period and then just rolling in and jumping into prices? And I guess then that leads into the sustainability of the boom. Obviously, some time's passed now. So when we last caught up, I think it was in September of last year, we were sort of saying, oh, it's pent up demand, it'll ease off. And now it seems to be continuing.
No, I didn't think it would ease off, because you've got two factors playing out together. So what you had over 2018, when it really hit badly, was that a lot of sellers brought forward their plans to sell.
Sure.
So you had a lot of the carnage being cleared in the market, whereas you're seeing prices go down and you think, I'm not going to wait until the end of the year. Let's get the house on the market now. And then, just as I think I mentioned last time, that the first indication that a market is going to turn, and we don't need to worry about how many properties are sitting empty for 12 months, we just need to know about what's happening in the buying and selling zone, right? Mm-hmm. The supply and demand zone. And the first indication that a market is going to change when it's been falling is that there's a shortage of stock. And that's exactly the same at the end of the cycle, where you get like a flood of foreclosures that hit the market.
Right.
And so that happened before the election. So we already saw that there was a marginal turn before the election came in. And then, I mean, everyone's right. I've never, ever seen a turnaround like it. It caught us all by surprise. I mean, there were queues outside down the street to get through properties, and auctions were going bananas. And very much a home buyer market that kind of came in. But because at that point, then the stock had dried up, and the confidence factors had come in, and then, you know, the banks had started to loosen up and there was that pent-up demand. The initial strength kind of came in and then that levelled out a little bit, and it has still levelled out, I think, a little bit from where it was. But right. I don't see it letting up just because there's so much... Because the other thing that was playing into the shortage of stock, of course, was construction tanked. I mean, even now it's difficult for developers still to access finance because the they're the riskiest ones that go. The banks don't want to know. I mean, they'd rather lend to the home buyer than they would to investors a second and then developers a third.
Right.
And because the product that they're building, the values of those products have not yet risen enough necessarily to where the land prices are to make a good enough profit for the bank to be able to lend. You know, even if we're looking at sites that have got plans and permits, it's difficult to get the finance to do the build.
Okay.
So we're looking at a market which is not going to have a flood of supply, I don't think, anytime soon. And yet we do have these factors that are keeping the buyers that are coming in. So it's not quite as stunning as it was just after the election where we thought we'd just like, woof.
Off it went.
You know, it's going to go, we're going to be in the 80s soon. I mean, the clearance, there's still properties that aren't attracting that much attention. And then there's properties that are attracting a lot of attention. But most of the properties that I buy, I'm up against other buyers, and I'm missing out by $5,000, or, you know, I mean, it's a close, there's competition in the market is what I'm trying to say. It's not necessary. We're still having to move quickly. We're still having to use those tools.
Yep. Okay.
Pre-auction offers.
Can I also ask, the data suggests that it's been driven by owner-occupiers. Is that what you're saying as well?
Yes, definitely. I've never had so many home buyers ever on the book.
Yeah, first-timers or upgraders?
I had a flood of first-timers, and then, I mean, you know, bear in mind I'm just one agency, so, you kind of need to look at other agencies. But I had a flood of first-home buyers, and now I've got some young couples that are kind of coming in and looking for their second home and upgrading into it. So I've had that too. And I'm constant. Most of my inquiries are coming from home buyers. And that's never been the case. Traditionally, all my inquiries come from investors. So, you know, but and these are buyers that, you know, the tragedy of the housing market is that you can't just be a home buyer. There isn't a home buyer. Because these are buyers that were looking in 2018 and not buying because the market was going backwards.
Right. Okay.
So you're not a home buyer. You know, you still want to buy. The last thing you want is what you purchased.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Backwards
in price, which is understandable. I mean, you don't want that in a sale item in clothing, let alone the house that you're going to buy. So, you know, a lot of the buyers that come to me, they've been looking for a period of time before they come around to me. So they've been looking and missing out. So, I mean, it's not... But I mean, I can't see that... I don't think the coronavirus is going to... I mean, I'm not quite so concerned about that, but I haven't looked into it as much. I think you guys have when you're looking at stats. But, yeah, I mean, I haven't noticed that there's been any impact from...
Just yet?
I mean, just the weakening economy. I mean, I think that's the general thing. But we spoke about that before, you know. I mean, it's not like we're in a real boom wage growth and, you know...
Low interest rate environment, perhaps, but not much else.
Can I just put something to you, though? So, because I'm coming from an economic point of view and looking at the stock markets and seeing the effects the shutdowns already have had on the Chinese economy and what's happening elsewhere, and saying, if this keeps going and I can't see a reason for it not... to stop keep going, then it looks pretty devastating. Okay, but so let's just put it back into terms, I guess, that would... So there's 100,000 Chinese students for Australia that are in China at the moment that can't get back here. Let's just say it goes on for another 3 or 4 months.
I'm guessing
a lot of those students aren't going to keep paying their current rent for 3 or 4 months.
Yes, that's a fair point, but the product that they're renting is only a minor part of the housing market. Is it really going to have a major effect? I mean, we're talking about for the housing market to tick over. You know, I mean, you've got a lot of your biggest buyer market are families with kids.
Sure,
it's not necessarily the students that are renting, and there is, you know, I mean, there's, you've got a point.
It's a shuffle up bit where it's like, I guess what I'm trying to get to is I'm just trying to work out what's the impact of saying, because I think for the most part these students will be still paying their rent at the moment, but as time goes on, and you know, we don't know what will happen, maybe it'll get reopened up again. I mean the university sector is obviously lobbying very hard to say, well, You know, can we just make a special exception for 100,000 extra people to come over?
Please.
Yeah, it's only 100,000.
Just spread the
yeah. Yeah. But let's just say, you know, from what it looked like to me, this virus spreads really quickly once it gets entrenched. We've got one cruise ship that's got 170 odd people or something like that that's got it from one. So generally speaking, you want to try and make sure that you're contained. Mm. If Australia says, okay, let's lock it down for 3, 4, 5 months, and all of a sudden we have a flood of 100,000 rooms, or maybe it's only 50,000, whatever it is, come onto the market, I guess that's my question of saying...
Yeah, well, I think...
Your rental market then starts shuffling down and people start saying, well, I'll lower my rents, and then you get to the stage where you're saying...
It's the apartment apocalypse that we were all talking about. It's the apartment market because the students are renting one-bedroom apartments.
Yes, and potentially more than one to the room.
You know, I mean, it's not the entire
market. My broader concern, not just the rent, is the we'll take the Melbourne economy because we're in Melbourne right now. It is probably the most dependent on the whole international student trade in Australia, and Sydney is as well, and it's particularly Chinese international students, and it's not just them not buying property; it's them not enrolling. The hit to the tertiary sector. Oh, they're not spending.
I'm going there next. Oh, okay. I'm just talking rent first. That's my first question. Is just on the rental side.
It's a cascading effect for the economy.
Yeah, that's right.
Tourism, everything.
And so then you start saying, like, if you've got investors on your books who have rented out to these, and then all of a sudden they stop getting their rent checks from their Chinese students for a few months, and then they go, okay, well, I'm going to find somebody else to put in it. And there are, let's say there's 25,000 new rooms in Melbourne that need to be let over the next 6 months. I'm guessing that's pretty devastating for the... Oh, sorry, not in Melbourne. Sorry, that's across Australia. So say there's 10,000 in Melbourne, you know, or 10,000 in Sydney.
I agree. I don't disagree. I mean, it's not a good prospect. Mm. It wouldn't be my investors because they don't buy apartments.
Yeah. Okay. And then
I get exactly what you're saying. I mean, that in that situation, if the situation really played out that far with this virus, then, I mean, it's not just that. I mean, there's all sorts of other impacts.
That's right.
That are coming into the economy.
That's
the
one effect. We're already talking about small businesses, tourism operators all over the place starting to say, well, you know what, I've got to close my doors. Yeah. Chinese restaurants saying, in the paper today, saying I've got to close my doors.
Yeah, box seal.
So then you start saying, okay, so those people are then saying, well, is there some forced sales of their property, or they're not going to be, a lot of small business owners often, high cash flow, are often investors in the property market as well. And so I guess what I'm saying, you're starting to take a little bit of that out. Then you've got your Chinese buyers who might still be keen to buy Australian property, but they're like, well, you know what, I'd actually like to look at it before I buy it. So, I mean, you are hearing stories about people who are buying them over the internet and getting agents to walk through with cameras to take photos and stuff like that, and I'm sure that happens. But I guess what I'm saying is
that
there will be...
But how long do you think that would play out for? How long do you think that it would last?
I think it's going to get worse.
Are we looking at years? Are we looking at months? Guess, are we looking at something being... Because
I think months at least... Yeah, it's very hard to see a case where...
Because a recovery would come, as soon as it would...
Okay.
Say that they managed to contain it and they managed to find some...
Yeah, sure. And I think there's a lot of people out there...
Which is what they're working hard to do. I mean, the idea is that people are getting sick and they're healing from it and they're... I mean, if you look at the stuff that Singapore has done, I mean, just Singapore on its own has pretty much... It has been... phenomenal in containing this and shutting it down,
making sure
that it doesn't spread.
But I don't know if you've seen any of the stats from China on just
Chinese. They've gone up by a third.
That's a lot of those back filling. The stats numbers aren't that bad in terms of the individuals, but I guess what I'm thinking is there's house sales in China are down 90% over the last from prior quarter on where it is now. The amount of activity that's going on in that sector at the moment is down dramatically in terms of, like, you look at the one of the things we love to look at is just the number of cars driving around cities like Beijing, and you can get sort of their data on the amount of congestion's gone from being an average of 70% to an average of like 3 or 4%. Like, it's just dramatic in terms of the amount of and the question there is there other flow-on effects and dead effects? But I sort of won't get you into that part, because there is an issue that does do people?
Yeah, I mean,
people afford to pay it if they're starting to lose out on their if they're starting to lose out on rent, and also other businesses? So if you're getting an ongoing and economic shock, if I said to you, there's a, call it a 3 or 4% economic shock to Australia, but very highly concentrated in a bunch of landlords, and very highly concentrated into a bunch of small businesses. And that's where I'm saying, well, if those people start losing and so I have to start going, well, I've got to sell my property, or I've got a portfolio of investment properties, I've got to start selling them. That's where my concern is that, you know, there's obviously a bullish view if everything goes well, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree. Mm. And I think that, I mean, obviously, you know, I mean, there are things that I mean, exactly the same as you, you know, I mean, is this going to escalate? Is it going to go? I mean, we just don't know, right?
Mm. That's right.
But one thing that you can compare it against is that what we went through in 2018 when the banks weren't lending and nobody was buying and everybody wanted to sell.
Yes.
Was a very similar thing.
Mm.
And it affected a whole multitude of businesses. And I would say that that almost had a bigger effect.
Mm-hmm.
Than something maybe like this, particularly in the stages that we're at now. I mean, the house is worth what the bank's going to lend. So if the banks, once your financial system shuts down, which really, you know, and the fall in across the entire market was the worst for 30 years. I mean, we were back. I mean, it wasn't the hit to the economy wasn't. I mean, 1991 crash was really bad, but that's kind of.
Yeah.
So you're trying, I mean, I don't know whether it would be something as bad as what we've just been through. Because that's what, I mean, people ask me all the time, well, how can house prices keep rising and won't we go through, you know, something similar to what we've just been through? But I can't see that my argument with that was, no, we're not going to go through something similar to what we've just been through because the banks aren't going to stop lending until we have a financial crisis.
Yeah,
because that's
the big issue, isn't it? Is there a debt crisis? Because as you're saying, we went through this huge house price fall, and we didn't really have a spate of bankruptcies
rates are so people could still afford to sit in their homes, even if they're. Yes. I mean, the ones that get caught in that situation. I mean, what normally causes the fall when you get to the end of that cycle is that there's been so much speculation and prices have gone up so much that interest rates are no longer rising in line with the economy improving, but interest rates are rising rapidly to stop the house prices, and the economy can't afford to pay the debt.
Yeah, yes-ish. So I agree with it. That's one part. But we went through that same cycle, and Perth prices fell right throughout the cycle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
But
it was all unemployment.
Yeah.
Because when people have to sell, they sell.
But I mean, it was, you know, Perth was a very unique situation.
Population wasn't going backwards, at least. Yeah. Population was still increasing.
Yeah, but
in Perth.
Yeah, but not by a lot.
Well, yeah, but higher than, say, the US.
But the thing is, in that whole... Remember, housing is a long-term good, and so the cycle of development...
Mm.
You know, I mean, I spoke to the Herald Sun yesterday, again, it was about the fourth interview I've done in the last few months on the number of developers that are going out of business. And why are they, you know, going into administration? And, of course, it's all because the developers have a long run into the building process. And so in Perth, you know, you had a whole... It was a very... If you look at Australia as a whole, we talk about Sydney and Melbourne a lot because Sydney and Melbourne are volatile markets. Mm. And if you look at them compared to, you know, what CoreLogic do, that wealth gap chart where they say Sydney prices are now 75% higher than Brisbane's. I mean, there's barely been any inflation anywhere else outside of Perth, which had the once in a our lifetime.
Generation. Yep.
The boom in the mining sector. It was a totally different situation that drove that. Very unique, a one situation that drove it, and then a heap of building, a heap of oversupply, population fluctuation going into that.
Yeah, I'll argue with the population. There was certainly an increase before in population, but
the population's going up now.
But it grew right throughout. In Perth, it grew right throughout the whole crisis.
Yeah, no, that's true. But the rate of change was massive. Like, Perth went through a ginormous population.
Went from going 5% to 1.5%.
Yeah, that's right. Well, no, it's not even 1%. It's 0.8%.
But it wasn't home buyers rushing into a market and buying in Perth that was kind of causing that. There was a heap of investors that were going to get
talking about the fall, though. I get the rise. The rise I get. I guess what I'm saying is we had exactly the same situation
where you get those kind of dynamics.
Yeah, and also also with Perth, I mean, Perth's population growth crashed at the same time as the dwelling construction ramped up. So
not crashed. I take offence to the word crashed.
Population growth crashed.
Growth crashed. Okay, sorry. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
It didn't say its population crashed, but it went from you know, I don't know, 3.5 to 4% population growth down to 0.6.
Yeah,
it's a massive change, and at the same time as population growth crashed, in Perth, dwelling construction went to an all-time high never before seen. Right. And it lasted for years as population growth crashed.
So
accordingly, Perth's rents declined by a quarter. Perth's rental basic vacancy rate went up to about 7%. It was an absolute disaster, and that's what happens when you get a one-industry economy, which is not diversified.
Excellent. That's exactly where I'm going to lead to the whole. Exactly where I'm leading to from the whole thing is, as I said, it's one-industry economy. But if we said, okay, well, Australia's got. We sell houses to each other and we dig stuff out of the ground. Yep, that's how we've got two industries.
And immigration.
And immigration. But so that's where I'm coming to is in the same financial circumstances, we get a boom from 2012 to 2017 in Perth, prices are falling because of rising unemployment and not even rising that much. Like it rose to from very low levels to maybe
six and a half.
Yeah, so, so I guess I'm just drawing the picture that if the coronavirus causes bankruptcies and causes students not to be here, you know, 100,000 students, call it whatever, 50,000 rooms across Australia, call it 25,000 rooms. It doesn't, you know, I guess the numbers are large enough. To me, that's a big negative effect it can have on the housing market.
Yeah, it's a negative effect, but you're asking me, whether is it going to cause the housing crash? Is it going to affect one sector of the housing market? How far is it going to have it? Say it was taken out. I mean, you're first of all taking one thing and then say, well, let's take it to its absolute extreme. And then what effect is that going to have on the economy? Can that affect the housing recovery?
Where's
it going to go? I don't think I'm taking
I get it, but I don't think I'm taking it to the extreme. I'm just saying, because at the extreme, I think there are housing crashes, and that's no problem. If you lock down China for 6 months or 9 months, then I think you are. But I guess where I'm coming to is, at what stage is your guess? And I'm just asking because you're in the thing, that when do Chinese students stop paying their rents if they've...
Well, we're
2 weeks in.
Well,
it's another 2 months, that probably stops paying their rents after 2 months.
If they think they're never coming back, they'll stop paying their rent.
Yeah.
If they hold that hope that they're going to come back, they're not going to let their room go
and you got stop the, paying you got their the bond, rent. You've got a bond in there as well, which buys you maybe a month's worth of grace financially.
So they've got to ruin their reputation for the next rental or whatever and stop paying their rent. I mean, I don't think it's going to happen. Personally, it's not something that... I take totally into account what you're saying. And like I said, I haven't looked at it.
It's not your area, I guess.
No one can really hide from what's going on, and I guess there's the side where you think the panic's going to cause more problems than what's actually happening, and then there's the side that kind of weigh in and say, well, hang on, we've got to take this a bit more seriously.
And I think I should make clear my point is I don't think there's a I don't think it's a continuum. I think there's a point where you reach where they start. It goes through the point where you start seeing companies fall over, and we've already seen a few companies fall over in Australia, but you start seeing large-scale fallovers of tourism and education, and then you start seeing...
Into property.
In property and people, and they're not paying their rent. I guess what I'm saying is I think it's a bit of a binary event. You either get enough that it actually turns into that self-fulfilling downward spiral, or, as you said, you go through this period where, it's depressed and everyone has to suck it in for a little bit, but then it finishes and there's a wave of... All of a sudden, there are students there, and there's a whole bunch more rooms to fill, and there's all these extra.
I mean, that's the only thing that I can compare it to is: would it be as bad as what we've just been through?
Mm-hmm.
That's in terms of the housing market, specifically.
Yeah,
if that's what we're talking about.
Well, I mean, to the
economy, because the housing market basically is the gravity to our economy, right? Mm. I mean, it's everything is built around how the tax system has encouraged you to invest.
I honestly think it could be worse for the economy, but it won't necessarily be worse for the housing market. Because, if China's a massive slowdown, stop coming, we'll lose tourism, massive export, education, massive impact on domestic demand, we've got commodity prices will tank. because obviously China will be, you know, buying less iron ore, etc. That's a big income shock for us.
Oh, it's all a lot of net negatives there.
Yeah,
isn't
yeah, it's a lot of negatives. But I mean, look, you know, forget about is housing going to crash, whatever. I mean, I don't know. I got no idea. We're just really spitballing here.
Yeah.
But the bigger thing is the current boom sustainable? That's my thing. And let's leave coronavirus out of there. I think it's a big fat tail risk.
Mm.
But the other thing is interest rates almost at their lowest they can go.
Mm.
I don't know what they can do after that. In terms of, you know, mortgages, etc. So there's obviously, yeah, you know, they're approaching their lower bound. There's not going to be that many more rate cuts.
And of those rate cuts, not that much is going to be passed on anyway.
Yeah. Because the problem is, I mean, what's the cash rate? 0.75? Yeah, 0.75 at the moment. I should know that, but, you know, Christmas and all that, forget. 0.75, right? So even if they did two more cuts, the problem is the banks can't go into negative net interest margin. So they've got to have a positive interest spread. So once you, even if you cut interest rates to zero, the banks have got to stop cutting because they've got to have a positive spread. So not much of that's going to be passed on. Mm. So once we hit the lower bound, well, what else is there for the housing market? You've got fiscal stimulus. I mean, Morrison would do the first home buyer splurge, no doubt.
That leads me just into a quick question, well, just before we move off the Asian influence. But so last time we spoke, Hong Kong was sort of right in the peak of its big unrest that it had, and it's still continuing to this day now. The coronavirus kicked it on again. As a, I guess, going back to that coalface sort of component of your role, did you see a rise in, I guess you don't know if they're from Hong Kong or whatnot, but did you see a rise of potential foreign investors in the sort of the spring and summer sales period at, say, auctions and things? And I guess the lead on for that question is perhaps we'll see that again from the Chinese market mainland after they've been cooped up in their house for 6 months and decide they don't want to live in China anymore, and perhaps they're looking to shift out as well. So
I mean that was an interesting question at the time, because I had some buyers that were looking in areas where that apparently, according to the agents, there were a lot of Hong Kong buyers that were looking.
Yep.
And I did have one buyer who asked me specifically, you know, was he negotiating against, you know, were we negotiating against Hong Kong buyers, because he had seen people go through the property. So I mean, it was something that was sort of front of mind at that point.
Yep.
But now it's not, like, it's okay. Now it's almost like it's slipped under the radar.
Yep.
With it, I mean, the Asian buyers, we had that Asian kind of wave that pushed on the first half of this cycle. So like after 2012, 2013, 14, 15 was bananas. I remember doing Four Corners at the time, and that was all it was about, going to the auction and videoing the Chinese and then asking them, how can you afford to buy a house? You look pretty young. How can you afford to buy a house? And it was all, well, it's my mum and my dad. I mean, I have quite a few clients from Indonesia and, you know, businessmen and people that are, buying for their kids that are studying over here.
Mm-hmm.
So they go and buy a suburban home, and then they're all working on how can they get over. And that's been a joyful ride. I've had some kind of interesting experiences with that, with the one with the renovations that they want to do to heritage listed homes. Let's just move from this one, it's heritage listed. No, we like it, we want to knock it down.
Would it be fair to say that because the most of the demand now is owner occupied, is a lot more robust than that situation? So you know, for example, like to get back to Damo's point, if we still have that situation from a couple of years back where it was, you know, lots of foreign buyers having a big influence, obviously the coronavirus, etc., would have a huge impact because they'd withdraw. But now, according to the ABS at least, the housing boom's been driven by owner occupiers, and you're seeing that.
Yeah.
But that also means it's likely to be more sustainable.
It's the owner occupier. You know, the places that attract the owner-occupiers are generally the places that get the growth. The capital growth comes from house prices going higher.
So mostly
kind of established suburbs.
And detached houses over apartments.
Detached houses over apartments always. I mean, the family homes, because that's your biggest buyer market generally, people that are into their life plan.
Yep.
You know, and they're not, an apartment's just not going to cut it. I mean, that's one reason why, it doesn't matter how well located an apartment is, your property is only worth what you can sell it for.
Yep.
And if your buyer market is a bachelor, you know, or to an investor who's going to rent it, mostly investors, then you just haven't got enough.
You
haven't got wage growth going into the market. And so they're just generally poor investments. And I cannot understand why there's still advocates and people that are advocating if you were looking for growth in the market to go and buy apartments. But you were talking about interest rates going lower. How can prices go higher?
No.
Well, is that kind of like...
Yeah, I mean, I just think because affordability is becoming so stretched, and probably by the end of the year we're going to be at record highs again, in real terms, against incomes, whatever. And without the RBA continually being able to drop the cost of credit, because it's going to basically hit its lowest amount it can get to. I just don't know what else can drive the market other than maybe a bit of fiscal stimulus. First home buyer bribes, etc.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I have, one of the things that I started doing recently was I write for Portfolio Publishing now, so I write a publication called Cycles, Trends and Forecasts, and that's been quite good because it leads me to do a lot more research sort of on the market. And one of the things I started writing on were these kind of joint venture people coming together. There's mortgage mates now,
yep.
Young kids can get together, and you know you've had the estate baron and the brick ex. And then I think I wrote, nicked from you.
Oh, of course. All the best ideas come from me.
What should I write about this week? I'll go and see what Leith's been writing about.
Who's an ideas man, that Leith?
There's going to be something interesting. Then you've written about Domicom.
Fractional investing, property investing.
Yeah, that kind of opened it to superannuation. So I did a weekly email on that, and then the guy who runs it contacted me and said, I come and see you? So I said, come and to my cafe where I spend my life writing. And that actually was really eye-opening because he's really gone through the courts to set up this platform, which was, I thought, mind-blowing. Where you can get to, he's got all the whole of the La Trobe lending and everything set up behind it, where you can buy any property now on the market with your mates as they do all the due diligence on it, so they check what the rental income is and everything. So you have to put down a bigger deposit, but the lending's sorted out. It's any property that's there out there on the open market. You know, they have a buyer advocate going out and buying it. And it was just one of those things where you're just kind of clicking, is this is more and more of this kind of thing that if you cannot buy, a bit like when, you know, I guess the REITs and things like that, you know, like companies go out and buy massive portfolios.
But you can do it on a small scale.
Small cap investor kind of going into that thing. And so, I mean, I think that there's always, I think that's one side of it.
Guess we've got 50-year mortgages, 75-year mortgages, 100-year
mortgages. There's always another way to get people into property.
I also think
other people's money.
Yeah, of course.
I also think that there is an argument there that Melbourne and Sydney just are... I mean, we know that Sydney plateaus out early because of affordability.
Yeah.
We know it's only so far it can go. And Melbourne's actually really going up, really gone up there as well. Not everywhere. I mean, there's always going to be suburbs where you can kind of slip, you know, that kind of gentrify on the outer scale. But there is an argument for those two states topping out early.
Yep.
And if not the home buyers going elsewhere, the home buyers just not being able to compete at a higher price, but the investors that perhaps might be able to drive it, or that kind of product that might be able to drive it going, and then looking at Brisbane, even, you know, dare I say, South Australia, but Perth, going into the other markets, that there could be a big swing around in those other markets that we just haven't typically seen before.
Are you seeing anything in the way of rental growth?
Marginally, but not much. No.
Yeah.
I thought that there'd be a burst of it when I was last here.
Because most of the ABS stuff is all flatlining.
So according to the ABS, I'll just give you the official, statistics. Basically, rental growth, 0% over the December quarter, but it was also the lowest ever recorded in history. I think it was 0.4% for the year nationally. But Melbourne's is growing, not by much, but Sydney, Perth and Darwin are all falling still. So... they're the ones that have driven it down. It's soft pretty much overall.
You kind of got to look at when construction is going to come back in, because nothing was... I mean, there was a heap of stuff that just...
Yeah.
A heap of developments that couldn't get built. Obviously, we had an oversupply that was soaking up. That's playing into now with the fall. So it's when that oversupply gets soaked up, and then if you're talking about apartments, you've got 4 years before an apartment block, a big apartment block kind of hits the market from the point of buying the land.
And I was just saying, as you're talking before, about saying there's all these apartments that started in a boom, went through a bust, But then they're not even finished yet, and they're still into the boom. And they're hoping coronavirus doesn't hit, so there's not another bust before they're finally finished.
I have some sympathy for developers, because I work with so many of them. Not developers are great, everyone wants to make, but it's really risky when you're like
just
building.
Just look at Perth, that's exactly what happened.
Absolutely.
Because you're always doing your FISOs on what things are selling for right now, and hoping that they're just not going to be less.
And also because Australia's becoming more of a high-rise market, especially in Sydney and Melbourne, it's a lot less responsive. So, you know, attached dwelling, detached house, I should say, can be built, you know, from approval to completion about 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
High-rise apartments, 2.5 years plus.
Yeah.
So, you know, unfortunately, you know, you can get the approval during a boom and start commencing it.
Yeah.
But then the bus comes and you finish it years later.
And that's 6 months, though. That's by an experienced developer. If you're doing it yourself at home, that could back to at least 12 months, probably 18 or 24.
100%, I mean, like 12 months and you haven't got plans and permits for 2 townhouses, let alone apartment block.
I've got another question for Catherine, just because I'm interested in it, basically. So we talked about this, you know, this high-rise plague. Have you noticed that your clients are... Like, do they hear about Mascot Tower? Do they hear about Opal? Do they hear about Lacrosse, which caught fire in Docklands? And are they worried about the quality of high-rise construction? Or are they completely oblivious? Is there any of the sort of nerds like me who read the news every day and knows about
it? I think that's a really interesting question, because I'm in the same kind of boat. I had a letter from one of my subscribers the other day who said in this long... terrible story about how he'd been encouraged to go and buy a new apartment in Brisbane, and you know, it all these problems that they'd had with the construction and how it gone backwards in value, and like, even he was an intelligent guy, like he wasn't stupid. I had a long chat with him on the phone, you know, to kind of talk him through everything that had happened. But and I said the same to him, like you always kind of think like you are, like when, because the obviously one of the things that I kind of abide by is the cycles, you know, kind of theorem, particularly with real estate, because it does seem to fit into this set long cycle and kind of averages between 16 and 20 years. But, you know, I was like, you always think someone's going to, surely this is going to be the thing that's going to pull down the housing market. And the apartment apocalypse story, and I've played into it in the past, has been going on for ages. I mean, those defects and people shouting down apartments since... they were started to build in the South Bank. People have been saying, you know, don't, your view's going to get built out. The commissions that were being paid, they were vastly overpriced, the commissions that the sales were being paid. And then, you know, Edwin, Amelia.
No, yeah, yeah.
Edwin kind of started talking about this. And anybody, I mean, I took some clients in that through the, even when the Eureka was built in the city, it was such poor quality. It looks so fancy from the outside. And I have a friend who's an architect, and she just specializes in facades. And I drove with her through the city. She said, I will never be out of work because look at this, like even the Eureka, like all the gold is chipping off thing at the top. Yeah. You know, so she was, I mean, those things, you think, like, why would anybody buy an apartment? I have no idea. You think that at some point people are going to stop buying them, but unfortunately, I mean, people still come to me saying, you know, I want to buy an apartment, and I have to show them the record of the apartment that they're looking at has gone backwards.
Yeah.
Because this guy who bought in Brisbane, he was convinced it was going to go forwards in price. He was just, you know, it's in a good location, I'm sure it's going
to
go forward.
As long as they don't build four more towers next door to it, we'll be okay.
The only people that ever make money from new developments, and it accounts for the same with townhouses, but to a lesser extent, a new property will always, in Australia, go backwards in price, unless you've bought it in the maddest boom market. You know, it's going to go backwards in price because the house is going to depreciate faster than the land value can go up. The only people that are winning are the developers who are doing the development.
Yep.
You want to be if you want a new apartment, develop a block and keep a new apartment in the block that you develop. But I mean, I live in an apartment block. I rent in an apartment block, which I love. I mean, I've got a great view.
Mm,
it's got a swimming pool and lifts and things.
Oh, well, there you go.
And rubbish chutes and things. But things are always breaking down in it. I mean, I'm really, really, really happy that I'm renting there. I'm happy.
So you haven't been Airbnb'd?
There's Airbnb. Actually, it's really quiet. It's not bad. I looked at the quality of the building. It's not bad, but you know, it's no. I mean, I would things break down all the time. It's a bit like living in a school dorm.
Yeah, and the lifts are always.
The building management are really like, do not eat in the common areas and do not make noise in the thing. But no, I mean, it's renters are the winners.
Yep.
In the apartment, because they can walk in and walk out.
Get all the benefits.
And not have any of those costs. Owner's court fees. The recycled rubbish chute is blocked again.
Yeah. But I mean, because in the end, for the average property, I mean, where you get your growth from, where you get your return from over a long period of time is you're either saying, my property, I'm getting a rental stream from it. And so I'm getting, you know, I bought 30 years ago, I was getting a 10% yield or whatever I was getting. And then, after fees, you're probably back to 6 or 7, but that's your return plus whatever rental growth I'm going to get if your valuation doesn't change. And so we've been through this big valuation change period, and maybe we've still got more to go on the valuation change. But over the long term, you've got to say, well, I'm getting my rental yield plus whatever the rental growth is, and rental growth is at all-time lows. There's probably a little bit more, as you said, that can be done on the valuation side of properties to push them up. But if you're buying them on a 2% yield or a 1% yield,
you're only buying it for the growth. Mm. I mean, it's the only reason that you buy that in Australia is because you're hoping that the price is going to be, someone's going to come along and pay more. Mm. And it's going to make it worth you paying the interest payments and everything. It's going to come out. I mean, that's the only, there's a lot of spruikers out there that talk about buying in regional areas. Regional Queensland is one. I'm writing a big piece on Brisbane at the moment, which has really had Horsley. I mean, it's had the growth in Brisbane for investors really hasn't been good long term at all, with all the kind of factors that came in, even the floods that kind of came in. So it's you have to really pick your areas carefully. But you know, you can't go out into these people that kind of encourage you, go out and buy in Southeast Queensland because it's got mad population growth. Well, it's also got a lot of developers that are drip feeding the market with constant supply, there's no capital growth in it. You're only investing in something like that for the small bit of rental income that you get. I'm not saying that you shouldn't do it. You've got to balance your portfolio, how you balance it. You've got to work it out how you're going to work it out. But you can't have the thing that, you know, there's certain ways where you can have capital growth and rental income, but they are ways where you kind of manufacture it. So create a rooming house in a nice suburb, then rent by the room.
Yeah, right.
And with the low interest rates, you're going to get, the land value is going to go up, and you're going to get, so that's
like
one,
a multiple
one
of rent essentially,
you know,
per rent.
or develop, split the land, do a development, split the land, you know, come out with your, hold on to them.
Yep.
You know, you've got one in income per properties and you're getting those kind of things. But you're not going to walk into and just buy a stock standard house and get capital growth and rental income. And that's what I'm often, that's the product where I can't seem to get some clients to understand that even if we go into Ballarat, you know, it's the great, unless they are holding for the 20 years or something.
Yep.
But there's the other thing we haven't discussed, because of things like the bushfires, the insurance companies that are not going to insure in those places. So there's that thing. I mean, that happened in Townsville with investors that were in Townsville with the flooding.
Absolutely.
And found that they actually weren't insured for flooding. They realise. Yeah. And that, I think that's going to hit with the bushfires. It's been one of the trends that I've had more of than ever is buyers that want to buy in regional location. So Ballarat, I had a couple of buyers in Ballarat.
And why? And, well, what's the reasoning behind? Just because of the value proposition?
Yeah, I mean, it's like I said, it's a hard thing where I actually tried to talk this buyer out of buying.
Is it positively geared? Is that what?
Yeah.
They're close to retirement, but they also wanted capital growth. But then they didn't want to be, you know, they wanted it to be at least neutrally geared.
Yeah, right.
And I tried, I said, look, let's not, right? Because you're not going to get a massive amount of capital growth. We're still, you know, I haven't been able to talk them out of buying a house, but I've given them every negative of it. But that was when all the smoke came. Do you remember that? Where the smoke, it was
over
really
the new year.
Just after the new year.
Yeah,
it was really smoky. And Ballarat, you know, the fires were kind of getting close to some of those regional areas. And I thought, you know, you just,
Well, there's stories too. I was reading one in, is it
Barrel?
I just say Mittagong. But where there were people purchasing land or houses in there, and then it was settling, and then they'd go to get insurance, and the insurer would say, no, we've actually cut off or stopped any new policies in that area because the amount of risks we're taking on board. And they didn't know that as part of their, I guess, due diligence. You just assume you're going to get house insurance once you buy. And so then they sort of, you know, had a very tense period through the fire period with no insurance after purchasing, you know, the dream home and everything, which is fascinating, absolutely fascinating.
And so I mean, that was one factor that I was thinking. But I think with people, you know, the way that I kind of see it is that, you know, and like it's that balancing that conflict of interest of kind of like hating the system and sort of seeing everything that you see, and then also
having to play by the rules.
Well, yeah, that's right. You have no choice, right? The tax system's kind of dictating how you invest. But I don't think that people need to necessarily, in that position, your one option to take advantage of our housing, you know, spruik economy is not necessarily going out and directly investing in property. There's all sorts of things that you can do. I mean, another very interesting meeting that I had. Well, there's Nucleus Wealth.
makes a fantastic segue into our property versus shares calculator that we've just released this week as well. But we'll put a link into the show notes for anyone who wants to check that one out. Does a fantastic comparison of that choice. People who are looking between property and shares as an investment.
But
all sorts of things.
You know, things like property development funds. I mean, I've had some very, very interesting meetings with people like, you know, Oliver Hume, that have got very strong record, long time property developers that kind of give great returns for. So again, it's that same kind of thing that if you haven't got the money to go and do it yourself, you know, lending into projects and stuff like that, if you understand, if you're confident about, you know,
the status quo being maintained.
Well, if you're not worried too worried about the coronavirus that we've got till 2026 for the peak now.
But one of the things I was going to say though as well is when you do those, you're not earning money. You're not earning money from your property investment. You're earning money from your services. So as you said, when you make a share house and you're going in there and collecting rent and you know different people wandering in and out, there's why you're getting more money is because you're doing more work to actually do that.
Or well, I mean, there's two avenues that you can go down with things like property development funds. Is that you can either lend money to the project and get a fixed return, or you can take the risk of the project and get a percentage of the profit.
Yes.
So there's two ways that you can do that. But the other interesting thing is on my Instagram feed and Facebook feed of the property spruikers. That's all I get. Is the one that's kind of catching my eye a lot is the Airbnb. You don't need to own a property. You don't need to. That what they're kind of doing is taking over other people's properties and Airbnb-ing them. So you can go in and rent
a property.
Yeah, I mean, I wondered how I haven't looked into it in detail, but I've seen a few adverts for it, and I did wonder whether I was just picking up American adverts. But it's this kind of thing of how to make money from Airbnb without even owning a property, but you're just kind of like renting it. You get someone else's property. I mean, I could do where I am, you know.
I'm sure
like,
that's a big
it's a fancy
component.
Apartment. I just get someone
well,
in.
Well, yeah, but that's just a classic asset liability mismatch. That's like we're sitting in a WeWork right now. That's like your WeWork. You go and rent your building out for 10 years, and then you rent it out for people like us on a month to month basis.
On a piecemeal
and all
basis.
You're doing is the same thing. You're saying, I'll take out a 6 or 12 month lease from somebody, and then I'll rent it out as an Airbnb on a night to night basis and take the thing that coronavirus doesn't hit, and all of a sudden I've got no one to move into my, you know, and I've still got to keep paying the rent.
Yeah.
And so
you're on the hook.
Yeah. But as you said, like these things are all.
They're all part of the same. They're all part of the same psychology that I want to make. I don't want to work for a living, which is the psychology. So here's the other one: is the
I want my capital to do my work for me.
Is on Facebook. I've got a few industry colleagues, friends on Facebook, and one is very kind of like high up there. I don't feel I can mention his name, but he posted this thing on Facebook about, you know, state land tax is too high and we have to, you know, get the thresholds are too low and the land tax is too high and we need to get rid of it and it's terrible for investors and it's crippling people. And of course, you know, I just couldn't help it. I just had to pile in and say, you know, like it's the best tax, you know, like land tax that is such a good tax and why aren't we attacking these other taxes? But what was really interesting, and because I just got completely all his followers, you know, we don't like it. We're supposed to.
Taxes, the one that I have to pay for
GST and all of
you poke the nest, didn't you?
Oh, look, it was. But it's interesting that that people who work in... Well, first of all, it's interesting that people that actually work in the industry cannot understand that if you take away state land tax, like if you... that property prices go... They can't see the correlation that prices go up and they don't understand how high prices affect the rest of the economy. They just can't see that that's a problem. They just think more investors will buy if we take away all of these, if we keep negative gearing, and that's good for everybody, including renters. Right. You know, that's kind of like that story. But but nobody kind of really sees the evil of kind of like income tax and the other ones that really do kind of carry those dead weight costs on the economy that just can't be met. It's just really difficult to sort of measure them. But I mean, the bottom of it, I mean, you can argue. I'm always being accused, like at Portfolio Publishing, because I do videos for some of the other guys there, interviews and stuff, and I'm always getting accused of stealing the widow, you know, stealing the wealth of widows and farmers, and how can you possibly go out there kind of advocating this? But I mean, the bottom line is it's up to people. It's up to voters to change it. And I just don't see any, you know, I think that the psychology at the bottom of it is that we don't really want to work for a living.
Well, very good. Well, look, mindful of time, we might just quickly look to finish up soon. But just a quick question, actually, just circling back on before when you started talking about some couples and a lot of owner-occupiers that are approaching you now, having had a look at the market over, you know, over the downturn. Now it's on up again. Maybe it's a bit of FOMO. Perhaps if you wouldn't mind just running through like an ideal client for yourself, or someone that, you know, obviously that you've been doing some good work for.
In anonymous terms.
I'm just talking about, you know, what's your sweet spot?
All I can say is that home buyers... I have to pick my words really carefully when I start talking about what's my ideal client.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, typical client, I guess.
Typical client. I mean, look, investors for me are really easy because I can sit down and explain. The workload can kind of fall on me, and I don't have to. It's not so much of an emotional roller coaster.
I was just
going to
say
ride,
that. Yeah.
And it's not so objective. Intensive. I mean, it's far more kind of like a pen on paper analysis of knowing what's good and what I'm going to be walking in with. And so that means that I do the process and they just stay out of it.
Yep. Okay, how much are you going to make?
The home buyers, on the other hand, right, are the ones that, you know, you kind of, it's far more rewarding at the end because you get the tears and the emotion and the, we've got a mortgage.
Got our dream house.
it comes kind of at the end of it. But I mean, I think there's a lot of the hardest thing about home buyers is that it's a real psychological run of, you know, the properties being advertised, you know, say, I don't know, 1.5 to 1.6, and you absolutely know that there's not a chance in hell that you're going to get it for 1.5 if you turn up at the auction. But they just want to go. Can we just go? We just try. You know, come on, you just spend an hour of your Saturday. So it's really a lot of education goes into that. I mean, the thing that I enjoy most isn't necessarily, I mean, I've been doing buyer advocacy for a long time now, and I mean, it's not kind of running around looking at houses, you know. I don't need to look at another house or attend another auction.
Yep.
But I do enjoy, like, talking and educating and writing about it and, you know, reading the stuff that you guys do and doing the analysis and kind of working out what's going to happen in the economy. And if that can benefit people, you know, to at least not overpay and to...
Yeah,
that's the bit that's honestly the bit that I enjoy.
We can never have too much information.
So if I didn't have to look for the houses and buy them, I could just talk to people.
Yeah, right.
And tell them about how the economy works. I'm passionate about that.
Yeah, sure. Okay, very good. And how can our listeners find some more about yourself, Catherine?
Well, they can Google me.
Yep.
Or they can go to my website, cashmoreco.com.au. Or they can look on the Prosper website. Or they can subscribe to... It's a very reasonable subscription price. Please do.
For Prosper?
For Portfolio Publishing, okay. For Cycles, Trends and Forecasts publication. You'll get all of my knowledge on that. A heap of information on real estate cycles and all the beautiful esoteric stuff that goes along.
Wonderful.
That goes along with it. So, yeah. they'll get that if they want to come along.
Okay, very good. Oh, there we go. Yeah, fantastic. Oh, well, thanks everybody for a terrific conversation today. I'm not sure if we quite solved the question of if the property boom's sustainable, but I'm sure we'll check back soon.
Coronavirus.
Yeah. Well, once we know a little bit more about the coronavirus, I'm sure we can come back and give some more substantial answers. So on that note, and I will just finish as well on a plug for our property and shares calculator. It's just timely that it came out the same week as we have had a property-based podcast. So we'll chuck a link to the slides and we'll put up the website as well. Coming up next week, we have portfolio manager of fixed income specialist Coolabah Capital. He's an AFR columnist and also finance commentator, of course, Christopher Joy. So we're looking forward to speaking with Chris during the week. Been looking forward to Chris getting on the show for some time now, and so I'm looking forward to hearing all about his many exploits and what he thinks he's coming up with for the fixed income world for Australia as well. So stay tuned for that one next Thursday, the 20th, 12:30 PM Australian Eastern Standard Time, or Daylight Savings Time, I should say. And on that note. Well, that's it for now, and thanks for watching. If you like what you heard today and you'd like to hear more, head over to nucleuswealth.com/subscribe, give us your email address, and in return we'll send you a weekly email with new webinar topics, links for our podcasts, and other news from Nucleus Wealth. I certainly hope you've got something out of today, as I have, and we'll look forward to catching you at the next one. Cheers.